May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Carter White from Northwestern University. Along with David Zubricki, we are representing the appellant, Marika Johnson. Her termination from Coppers, Inc. was surrounded by suspicious circumstances and factual disputes that point towards discrimination. Therefore, summary judgment against her was improper. This Court should reverse the District Court's grant of summary judgment under both the direct and indirect methods of proof. Turning first to the direct, Johnson presented evidence under a cat's paw claim that showed her coworkers' discriminatory animus proximately caused her termination. The coworker, Michael O'Connell, displayed plenty of animus against Ms. Johnson, but what shows it was discriminatory was his false accusations of race and gender-based slurs. Ms. Johnson never made those statements. He made them up in a deliberate attempt to get her fired. She has consistently denied making those statements, and he will not be available to testify otherwise. Now, the discriminatory part of the animus comes from what he made up. He could have invented anything about her, but he chose to impute to her race and gender-based slurs. And a reasonable jury could infer from that that he himself harbored a race or gender-based discriminatory animus. A reasonable jury could also infer that that animus proximately caused Johnson's termination because he exhibited it in an attempt to get her fired. And if a jury can infer that it motivated one attempt to get her fired, it can infer it motivated a later successful attempt to get her fired.
What really got her fired was the logbook episode, which resulted in a shoving match, apparently, outside the foreman's office or immediately at the door of the foreman's office, not the earlier racial epithet episode. That may, as you argue, illustrate the discriminatory animus of the coworker O'Connell, but what really got her fired was the later shoving episode, which was witnessed by an independent third party non-employee who was on the scene and who was consulted by the supervisor who made the termination decision here, and that witness sort of made the difference in the he said, she said, as I read the record. O'Connell, the co-worker with the discriminatory animus, said one thing about what happened. She denied it, and then this third party, who was, I guess, the janitor on the scene and didn't have discriminatory animus, said he saw it and it was a shove, and that's what got her fired. So why doesn't that break the causal chain?
It doesn't break the causal chain, Your Honor, because that janitor was seen talking with Mr. O'Connell. The person that observed that conversation used words like it wasn't facts, everything was against Johnson, and they were getting their story straight. So a reasonable jury could infer from that
there's more to it than that, though. The supervisor who made the decision investigated this conspiracy theory and determined that there was nothing to it.
Well,
and so the decision maker looked into whether the third party witness, the janitor, was put up to this by O'Connell and determined that he wasn't, and so credited his testimony.
For this court to come to that conclusion requires it to credit the decision maker's deposition testimony. And
is there any contrary evidence? It's my question. I mean, if there is some contrary evidence in the record that would discredit that, then I haven't seen it, but maybe it's there.
Well, Your Honor, I would refer you to A37 and the notes Mr. Wagner, the decision maker, took while speaking with another coworker, Tim Wright, who observed that meeting. And from those notes, that is evidence that the decision maker was on notice that this conspiracy was going on. And that is evidence that they weren't just deciding what to do next, which is what Mr. Wagner claims to have believed.
Those have to be construed in light of what the supervisor's deposition testimony was, because he explained it in the manner that I've just described, that he was given notice that there was a conspiracy underfoot, and he investigated that and determined that that wasn't the case. And, in fact, the person who those remarks were attributed to said he didn't, in fact, hear anything that was being said. So to the extent that the notes say that this Tim Wright overheard a conspiracy, he later clarified that, in fact, all he did is see them talking. He didn't hear what was said.
Well,
so why isn't the supervisor, why doesn't it that neutralize that whole line of evidence here? Unless there's something else to it that I don't know. But that's all, as I understand it, that's in the record.
There's also a transcript from an arbitration hearing, R55, Exhibit 10. And in that, Mr. Wright testified that while he didn't hear the entire conversation, he certainly did hear parts of it, and that he did not take them out of context. And all the decision maker said was that Mr. Wright wasn't a party to that conversation. That arbitration testimony, as well as his notes, indicate that he was a party to the conversation.
And what does the arbitration record say about what he overheard?
Well, it's just a snippet of the arbitration. We just get the end of his testimony. And on cross-examination, he was asked, is it fair to say you didn't witness the whole conversation? He said yes. And when asked if he took things out of context, he definitively said no and explained why. And in terms of the decision makers, you said he investigated it, but all that investigation revealed was the people in that conversation denying it and saying, no, we didn't do it. So that's not any...
Well, also, Tim Wright himself said he didn't hear what was said. He just was drawing some inferences.
No, that's not true, Your Honor. He didn't hear the entire conversation, but he certainly did hear parts of it, and it was enough for him to conclude that they were collaborating against Johnson.
Did he stand by that in the arbitration, that he heard them collaborating against Johnson?
It's not entirely clear from the record whether he did.
Yeah, that's the problem here, I think. I just don't know that the record is sufficient. I mean, we don't have a deposition from him, right?
No, we don't, Your Honor.
So?
Well, there is, I think this, in addition to the direct proximate cause, I think this also goes to the pretext question, and there's other evidence of pretext, namely that the decision maker was on notice that O'Connell had made things up about Johnson and wanted to get her fired. Now, I see I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so if there are no further questions, I'll reserve that time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll hear next from Ms. Maricki.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Smirky, and I'm of the firm Fagery Baker Daniels, and we represent Coppers, Inc. The district court properly denied Ms. Johnson's motion for summary judgment on the direct method of proof and entered summary judgment in favor of Coppers. This decision was correct and should be upheld. I will not go over the facts, which are detailed in Copper's brief, but I want to remind the court that Ms. Jackson was terminated because she was witness shoving a coworker accused of no wrongdoing in the incident. This was after Ms. Johnson had engaged in prior acts of physical violence, was warned that future acts could result in termination, was trained, and still continued this behavior. First, as to the direct method of proof, Ms. Johnson attempts to prove this through the cat's paw theory, which itself is based on a theory of projection. Ms. Johnson's argument under the direct method of proof fails for two reasons. First, she failed to show discriminatory animus, and second, she failed to show that Mr. O'Connell was the proximate cause of her termination. Let me elaborate on each of these points briefly. Ms. Johnson failed to show discriminatory animus for two reasons. First, she waived this argument. She asserts under the projection theory that discriminatory animus is shown by Mr. O'Connell's statements in 2007. However, this projection theory was not raised until a motion for reconsideration and thus was waived.
I don't think it requires a specific name. The argument was made that the comments from the earlier incident were tinged with racial and sex-based discriminatory animus, and that seems to flow readily from what was said, which I won't repeat here in the courtroom because it's pretty nasty, but suffice it to say, we don't need to call that projection theory in order to conclude that at least a reasonable jury could infer race and sex-based animus from what he accused her of accusing him of. Well, all that happened in the later motion for reconsideration was that a name was put to this theory. That's sort of irrelevant.
Correct, Your Honor. And to the extent the court does not find waiver, however, there's no evidence to support this projection theory. The projection theory is just that. It's a theory. Ms. Johnson provided no evidence in the record.
I'm suggesting it doesn't need a theory. Let's just put aside whether there's a social theory that supports this. Isn't it just a matter of common sense that something like what was said here evinces racial and sex-based bias? I mean, he was racializing her.
Actually, Your Honor, I would disagree. If we're going to base it on a theory of projection, you would have to have some sort of evidence in the record, even expert testimony potentially.
Yes. Well, the jury just reasonably infer that from what was said?
I don't think that that's a fair assessment. In fact, even the scholarly articles cited in the briefs indicate...
We don't need arguments. We don't need any theories. We don't need anything like that. We just need common sense. People don't say things like this to each other unless they've racialized each other.
Correct, Your Honor. But in this case, Mr. O'Connell is accusing her of making these comments. And in her own deposition, she admitted she had on occasion called him, excuse the language, a dickhead, which... is somewhat consistent with...
more to it than that.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
That might not be racial or gender-based. And I would grant you that people say that all the time without evincing improper discriminatory animus.
You're traveling in a different crowd than I am.
Yeah, I don't hang out in locker rooms or anything like that. But, you know, I get that. But there was more to it than that. It was the combination of what he accused her of saying to him.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would say that, interestingly, in her own testimony, though, she's admitted making comments of a race-based nature about white people as well. So it's not a stretch for a reasonable jury could find she actually did make those statements.
Well, that's not the standard, though. Have any other courts adopted this projection standard for saying that somebody's charge of racial or sexist animus shows that they are themselves racist or sexist?
I have not found cases to that effect, Your Honor.
And I frankly am a little concerned about the theory being used to turn, and this goes beyond summary judgment, but in essence being used to turn victims into the accused in workplace racism, sexism, etc.
Correct. I think that that's a fair assessment, Your Honor, but I would say in this case it wasn't substantiated. Ms. Johnson's own deposition testimony does not give any indication she believed Mr. O'Connell was projecting. She just simply denied that she made the statements.
Could I ask you a quick question about the stipulation that O'Connell wasn't going to be called? He refused to be deposed.
Actually,
District courts do have the power to send out the marshals if need be.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would agree with that. But Ms. Johnson didn't take those steps in this case. My understanding, I was not involved in discovery in this case, but my understanding of the situation was that they had attempted to serve him at work. My understanding was he was on a medical leave at the time. When service didn't occur, the parties agreed to stipulate they would not call him. So there were no extraordinary methods, a motion to compel or something along those lines to get him to testify. Now, most importantly under the direct method of proof, Your Honors, is the fact that Ms. Johnson did not produce any evidence Mr. O'Connell was the proximate cause of her termination. I think this issue is troubling because what basically Ms. Johnson believes is that she can discredit an extensive investigation involving numerous witnesses by merely alleging that the person who prompted the investigation dislikes her. Under Ms. Johnson's reasoning, she can mistreat coworkers with impunity as long as she casts doubts on their motives for the complaints. This is not a logical extension of the cat's paw theory. Mr. O'Connell only reported the shove. He was not further involved in the investigation. He did not interview witnesses, and he was not involved in Mr. Wagner's determination to terminate Ms. Johnson.
Well, he was the complaining witness and you know, the victim of the shove, according to his version, and he was interviewed in the course of the investigation, and it was basically a he said, she said. She said she didn't do it. He said she did, and then this third-party witness was the tiebreaker, as I understand the record.
Well, and I would agree with your Honor. Mr. Wells actually was the tiebreaker. He was the intervening cause. He was a third-party witness who also wasn't a Copper's employee who saw this shove and reported that to Mr. Wagner. So I think it's fair to say with an extensive investigation like what's detailed in the record with a third-party witness, you have sufficient support to say Mr. O'Connell was not the cause. It was the shoving of the coworker witnessed by a third party.
Right, and that's by virtue of the existence of this third party independent witness with no animus, who wasn't put up to it by the employee with the discriminatory animus, at least so far as the record as it currently stands demonstrates. Not because there was a good faith investigation on its own. After Staub, that doesn't matter. We just look at whether there's proximate cause from the employee with the discriminatory animus to the decision.
Correct. And I think that the investigation in this case, in addition to this not being a he said, she said, with having that third-party witness, breaks that causal connection. Next, I would like to discuss briefly the indirect method of proof. The district court was correct when it entered summary judgment in favor of Coppers on the indirect method of proof. Ms. Johnson has failed to prove discrimination under this method. First, she was not meeting Coppers' legitimate performance expectations. Shoving a coworker in violation of their code of conduct does not meet those performance expectations. Second, Ms. Johnson and Mr. O'Connell were not similarly situated. At the time of her termination, Ms. Johnson was accused of shoving Mr. O'Connell. Mr. O'Connell was accused of no wrongdoing in that incident. If you look at their disciplinary history through time, Ms. Johnson had previously been accused of two physical altercations. Mr. O'Connell had never been accused of any physical altercations.
Well, he threw something at her, right? And he threatened her life.
What I would say, Your Honor, with the distinction with the vinyl glove throwing incident, the district court actually went back and amended their decision to look at the facts more favorably in light of Ms. Johnson and said that he threw the glove and pen in her direction, not at her. She didn't even testify that he threw it at her. Her testimony was she thought he threw it in the direction of her or Mr. Gerba, and then at another point in her deposition, she said he may have thrown it at the trash can. She didn't know.
Right. This all gets to sort of a qualitative analysis about whether they're roughly comparable or comparable enough for purposes of comparison under the indirect method. So, you know, he's got the throwing something at her and threatening to kill her. She's got the prior incident in the guard shack with wielding the stapler against the guard and the shove. And so why isn't that sort of roughly similar? He doesn't get fired, she gets fired.
Well, I would say the similarly situated standard is a flexible standard. We do agree on that. But I think the issue here is that the alleged death threat is not even comparable. Ms. Johnson had not even reported the death threat immediately. Her response to it was, yeah, okay. And she didn't take it seriously. The supervisor that actually disciplined Mr. O'Connell for this alleged death threat said that the discipline wasn't more severe because he had heard Ms. Johnson had laughed when she heard about the death threat. There were no witnesses to this death threat, and the discipline meted out for the death threat was by a prior supervisor, not Mr. Wagner, who made the determination. And I understand there can be some dispute about whether strict following of the supervisor guideline is necessary, but here, where the adverse employment action is dependent on the supervisor's judgment, you have to take that into account. Finally, I see I'm out of time. If you don't have any more questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Zubricki.
May it please the Court, David Zubricki for Appellant. I'd like to just briefly touch on a couple of topics in response to Coppers. First, Judge Sykes, to respond to your inquiry as to whether or not the tiebreaker and the witness, Wells, is enough to address the issue of pretext. He, in fact, was not a neutral third party. There is evidence in the record that he owed money to Michael O'Connell. And I think you have to look at the rest of the investigation that Wagner did. He interviewed Michael O'Connell, who he was already on notice for knowing that O'Connell made up false accusations before. Xavier Kenyatta said that he saw the push, but later evidence determined that he physically couldn't have seen it the way he said. And throughout the entire episode, Marika Johnson disputes it. Next, I want to talk about Marika Johnson's supposed insubordination. Counsel for Coppers draws a narrative, and they try mightily to do it, where Marika Johnson is an insubordinate employee who walks around treating coworkers with impunity. And that's just not the case. They take a guard shack altercation and turn it from a mutual event into a one-way assault. They take the radio incident in which Michael O'Connell was the instigator and for which Marika Johnson received more harsh discipline, even though she didn't even get to tell her side of the story first, and they say that's another mark on her record instead of further evidence of Copper's discrimination. The problem is you can only get to that narrative if you draw inferences in favor of Copper's, and based on the summary judgment posture of this case, that's improper. This court has held in Filar and Kodish that where there are two stories that can be told from the facts of the case, even though a district court may want to draw one of those stories, it's not there for them to say. They have to resist the temptation and send it to the jury. Finally, I want to address the issue of proximate causation. There's no question of animus here. Michael O'Connell did not like Marika Johnson. He also caused her firing. She disputed the push. He was there. He said that it happened. He got people to say that she pushed him. And so to say
that... He got people to say she pushed him.
Well, I think a reasonable jury could infer that... That Michael O'Connell influenced other people to
how?
Well, he was a well liked person in the workplace, and he had friends there.
Being well liked translates into being somebody who impresses other people.
Excuse me.
Translates into being somebody who forces other people to tell lies.
I don't think he forced anyone to tell lies.
Just being a nice guy. He decided to lie for him?
I think that there's enough evidence on the record that a reasonable jury can infer that he proximately caused
her interesting theory.
Termination.
Well, but we don't have his testimony, and we don't have the testimony of any of these witnesses
right
in the record. So, I mean, there isn't anything to support that. It has to be, I mean, your argument is premised on the recounting of how the investigation went down by the supervisor, and he said he resolved the dispute about the conspiracy theory in favor of no conspiracy. Nobody had been put up to anything.
Right, well, I think that's where the district court erred in crediting his deposition testimony,
well,
which was just
there isn't anything to call it into question. I think that's the problem here.
I think the fact that one of the people that he interviewed was later turned out to physically have not been able to see it, that Michael O'Connell had a history of lying about Marika Johnson, and that the other man owed him money is enough evidence to dispute it. I see that my time is up, so if there are no further questions.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. And, again, our thanks to the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern Law School for your assistance to the court and to your client. The case is taken under advisement.